Welcome to If You're Just Joining Us. I'm John Armstrong. This week I'm speaking with Minister Faust, whose book, From the Notebooks of Dr. Brain, won the PKD Special Citation. Minister Faust, whose real name we'll get to in just a moment, is a Canadian teacher, a writer, a community activist, radio host, and political aspirant. A quick note about the audio quality. First couple of questions were recorded on the phone, and the rest of the interview was then done with two studio mics. So it does change there in the middle. Don't be alarmed. Well, first of all, congratulations on the Philip K. Dick Award.
Well, thank you.
So your name is Malcolm Azania.
Yes, although for the purpose of your podcast, I'm hoping that you'll just keep me as Minister Faust.
Okay. Well, I was getting to that, and your nom de plume is Minister Faust. So I want to ask, who are these two guys, and which one of them is mild-mannered?
Well, my civilian identity is so-called, that's the Clark Kent. And my Minister Faust personality, that's all of my more boisterous characteristics. And I guess to the extent that, it even sounds vaguely sane to be talking about alter egos and, you know, all that. I mean, the bottom line is everybody, without realizing it or without having actual pseudonyms, everybody operates with a variety of multiple identities. If you're, you know, in one context, you're dad, somebody else, your son, somebody else, your husband or lover, somebody else, you're, you know, the teacher in the classroom, or the manager or the shop steward or whatever. So really, and when we make those shifts in our identity, or at least in our role, I suppose, with that comes a different way of talking, a different, you know, level of intimacy or humor or whatever. And all that happens when you're, you know, if it's a public spotlight or semi-public or remotely public, is the case of a writer, you jazz it up a little bit more, because that's part of the mystique of, you know, selling books and all that. And, you know, and people have a couple of strong reactions. I mean, I get a lot of people saying, wow, that's so neat. I got to buy a book by somebody named Minister Faust. I mean, I've actually heard, you know, people send me emails saying that. As my work as a journalist, I've been doing a lot of interviews with the people who create the TV series The Wire, and, you know, David Simon, the creator, wrote back and to my request for an interview and said, "Well, I will speak to anybody named Faust." So, you know, that's great. You know, other times, you know, you read online, somebody says, you know, "Oh, how pretentious! I've never read something by somebody named Minister Faust." So, but you know, that person wasn't going to like what I had to write anyway. So, really, good riddance.
In your book, The Notebooks of Dr. Brain. That is Dr. Ava Brain Silverman. Could you tell us about that character?
Yes, and I like the fact that you said Ava as opposed to Eva, because nobody has really, you know, caught the fact that her name sounds a little bit like Ava Brown. So she is a caricature of some of the worst and a little bit of the best of what passes for counseling in North America and, you know, traditional psychotherapy. And I have read, I mean, a lot of people denounce self-help books, and mostly it's people who haven't read any, which is entirely dishonest intellectually. I mean, how you can dismiss an entire genre? Dismissing self-help books as a genre is like dismissing science fiction as a genre, not having read a single book. So I've read some, and lots of people that I know have read some. The only types that I read were usually after a bad breakup, and I could feel my head ready to explode. I needed to, you know, cool off somehow, and one way to do that was to, read a book that dealt with breakups or something like that, and usually found a little bit of sanity through that. But what I found was that almost all these books, even with some good advice, the prose was usually awful, and it was just ripe for being caricatured. And, you know, I mean, in fairness, they're counselors. They're not, you know, prose stylists. But, you know, I just couldn't resist it. It was just, it's sitting there. It's waiting for you to go after it. Nobody else is doing it. I figured, I'm going to do this. And so, you know, Dr. Brain is, on her negative side, she's typical of much of, from what I can see in psychotherapy, in that she doesn't understand political structures, She doesn't understand the politics of race. She doesn't understand economics. So everything is about the individual. She understands a teensy-beensy bit about gender politics and a little bit about homophobia, but really not that much. So she sees things on the surface and thinks that she's being deep. And so she is wrong a lot of the time, but at the same time, she is actually right sometimes. And to me, it's much more interesting to write somebody who is sometimes right. And otherwise, as a writer, you're just being a bully. You're just saying, well, you know, look at these idiots. They're never right about anything. I mean, that's really unfair.
So in the book, her clients, so to speak, are like superheroes. So were you a big fan of comics growing up?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I still got about 3,000 comics around the house.
I wasn't assuming you'd grown up, so yes.
John, you rascal. I love comics, and following reading work by Alan Moore, it was pretty hard to read most comics anymore, because when you've read stuff that's at that level of insight and sophistication, most other stuff is pretty disappointing. You know, I mean, hard to read Avengers or Secret Wars after you've read Watchmen or Miracle Man. But what remained, though, was my delight of, the trappings. I mean, the trappings are really fun. And I think, no matter how hoity-toity and sophisticated people get in literary, their enjoyment of literature, although nobody in an English department would ever dream of using the word fun anymore, if writing and reading aren't fun, well, I mean, what are you doing, you know?
You're listening to If You're Just Joining Us. I'm John Armstrong. I'm talking with Minister Faust about superheroes.
I mean, and that's one thing that superheroes will continue to give, is a real delight. And Alan Moore, after, he created Watchmen, he observed how the inevitable slew of imitators came out. And, that's the way it always works. You get a great breakthrough, somebody achieves brilliance, and everybody says, I'd like to do that. But unfortunately, a lot of the people only understand what's on the surface and not what's below. Moore felt that within a few years of following Watchmen, his work had actually led to the further degradation of the superhero form. And that you had a lot of dark, grim, depressing comics, but that ones that didn't really have any meaningful social insights. They were just more violent and more antisocial, that kind of thing. And so he did, a few projects which focused on returning superheroes to a state of wonder and awe, which I think are two of the most important words in science fiction, wonder and awe. And, I mean, yes, that's true in fantasy as well, but at least with superheroes and science fiction, there's some chance that, some of it might be rooted in some kind of science. And the best of those projects was called Top 10, which was about a pretty much an all-superhero universe or world. Everybody in it had some kind of a power. And there's a police squad called Top 10, and they investigate crimes. And what was wonderful about this was seeing all these little weird, idiosyncratic, I don't want to call them gags because that seems to belittle them, but just sort of fun ways of marveling at the details. And so that was an inspiration. And actually, before Alan Moore had done that, Kevin O'Neill had done that on a comic called Martial Law. So those were some of the influences from the notebooks of Dr. Brain.
You do a lot of things. I mean, writer, community activist, radio host, and we'll get to maybe politics in a moment. Have you ever drawn comics?
Yes. Interestingly enough, you're the first person, and of course my first book also, dwelt in these worlds. You're the first person who's actually ever asked me that. And yeah, I did. In fact, when I was about 10, that was the first time that I learned about the concept of the comic book auteur. It was because Frank Miller was writing and drawing Daredevil at that time. And I already knew that I wanted to draw comics by age 10, but I guess within a year I'd made up my mind that I wanted to write them as well. But yeah, I love drawing. And, you know, I had Stan Lee and John Buscema's book, How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way. And, you know, I proceeded to get better and I achieved a certain level of competence at drawing individual, you know, pictures. And I guess I drew some actual, you know, comic book pages that told stories, and you know, some of it was okay. I suppose if I'd really pushed myself, I could have achieved. And my home province of Alberta had, you know, was at that time producing a guy who ended up being a superstar in comics, Todd McFarlane. So, you know, and John Byrne was from a suburb of Edmonton. And so, I mean, there were local role models, but you know, the bottom line is, drawing a page and inking it is a day's work. And you can type a page in, you know, less than an hour and change it as many times as you need, and it's not really all that difficult. If you make a mistake on a comic book page, you got to start over, you know? And just, drawing comics is just so demanding, and most of the people that I knew who made it, like, I mean, I knew a couple of guys who weren't the superstars, and it was just a horrible life. I mean, they were working for peanuts, and they were working incredibly long hours. One guy, he got his big, it was kind of that sort of classic Hollywood, you know, shot, you know, he got his first big film, that sort of thing. And he was doing a mini series, and he was drawing it and inking it, and he was also doing halftones with gray markers. And he didn't leave his apartment. He was doing a page a day of all three of those things, and he didn't leave his apartment for something like until day 30. When he had to go get art supplies, and he said that it was the most exciting day he'd had as long as he could remember, because he'd been a virtual prisoner. And I thought, well, you know, if achieving your dream looks like this, and the dream is drawing comics, I gotta get the hell out of here.
Shifting gears. 5 years ago, you were on a reality TV show in Canada called Political Animal.
You've been doing your research, John.
Well, thank you.
I'm a little afraid of now where this is going, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, I would like to know two things. What was that like, and which animal were you?
Well, that experience was, to say the least, extremely disappointing, because I had already, I mean, the so-called reality TV, which is really game shows, the new game shows, I had already had, like many people, a very strong reaction against these game shows. Because they are, you know, they're crafted in order to render real people into caricatures of themselves, edited so that they can have a clear villain and a clear hero, all that kind of stuff. And I, you know, being a critic of media, I felt, you know, that this is a kind of furthering the agenda of making people suspicious of each other and finding their salvation in buying products, because, you know, people might let you down, but at least there's that new lipstick. And I was a school teacher, and the first season of Survivor came out, and I asked my students, so what was the lesson you learned from Survivor? And they all said, well, it teaches you can't trust anybody. And I said, well, you know, really, the show teaches you that you can trust almost everyone, because most people couldn't play that game effectively because they wanted to be trustworthy and they weren't sneaky, conniving people. And the problem with Political Animal was that those of us who were asked, and I didn't apply for it. I was asked to be part of it. I was told that I was going to be given the opportunity to discuss, debate, politics, to put forth ideas that might be for the benefit of the country. And I wasn't under the impression that this one show was going to change the country, but there are these things called citizens assemblies that are essentially fora for people to engage in political discussion, which can be a small part of a larger process of a country renewing itself. And I thought this is what I was going to have the opportunity to do, and this is what I was told I'd have the opportunity to do. And instead, I was deceived. You know, I got down there, I was, you know, one of the questions I'd had before I got there, I was told all the three candidates were going to have political advisors who are real people from the field. And I said to the show's creators, well, you know, why would any of them want to work with, a Kenyan-Canadian leftist who doesn't even have a full head of hair, you know? That doesn't really sound like a political consultant's dream candidate. And you know, I was told directly, oh, no, no, don't worry. We've got people from across the political spectrum. There's definitely somebody who'll want to choose you. I was figuring, okay, fine. What I didn't know, and what the political consultants didn't know, and of course you know since you saw part of it, or at least you researched it, is that, in fact, they were going to switch us so that we'd be working with our political opposites. Now, that makes for an amusing game show, but it's born out of deceiving the people who are part of it. Now, you might say, well, big deal, it's a game show. Aha, but this is a game show that was put together by CBC journalists, the most prestigious crew of journalists in the country, on a show that had a high reputation up until that point, called, I think, I want to say Disclosure, I'm not sure, I think that's the name of it. So journalists aren't supposed to engage in deceit. You know, like, this is a pretty straightforward, you know, perspective. Journalists aren't supposed to be deceiving people. They're supposed to be doing the opposite. And worse, the show was produced in such a way that everybody involved in the large constellation of what is politics was made to look bad, with one exception. And that exception was journalists. And anybody who was a critic of how politics operate in a Western bourgeois democracy has to know that mass media is one of the worst culprits in maintaining the status quo for those who are powerful. And I happen to believe in the axiom of journalism that says the role of a journalist is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And this show was about, I mean, one case they had a woman who was, in fact, I think a city councilor from Lethbridge, Alberta. A nice lady. I met her through the program. She was smart, and she, you know, she cared. And the show was cut in such a way to make her look like an idiot. And, you know, I mean, I got out once I realized that it was a setup. And I told them point blank, I said, look, I signed a release form. I didn't sign a contract. I can leave anytime I want. But it was very upsetting because I, like a lot of Canadians, operated under this myth that said that the CBC was this kind of bastion of, you know, these sort of crusading journalists who care about freedom and, you know, defending the little guy. And then I realized, man, you know, given the opportunity, they were quite ready to stick the bamboo shoots under the fingernails of just some ordinary people who happen to care about their country.
For ratings.
Well, yeah, for ratings, exactly, you know. And, you know, that means that that right there, I mean, yes, people do have to, I understand people have to earn a living. But, you know, there had been a previous series, and I'm forgetting the name of it, but I think it was on CTV, CBC's rival network, main rival network, and it was done in collaboration with Maclean's Magazine, which is kind of like Newsweek in Canada. And it was about a citizens' assembly, and it was, you know, a group of Canadians from across the country who were brought together. And, of course, as you and many of your listeners might know, unlike the United States, which fought a civil war over separation, Canada is in a permanent state of the potential for secession because of the province of Quebec. And so, you know, there's a lot of hard feelings across this country, inside Quebec against the rest of Canada and outside of Quebec against Quebec. And here was a citizens' assembly that brought people who saw themselves as enemies. And the purpose of the show, and this is what I love, and it just shows how our predominant paradigm about how you make interesting television and news is founded on a lie, which is that it's all about people fighting. This was a show about people working ultimately together. That these people actually drew closer together and understood that maybe there was a way that this country could work for everybody, or there were some ways. And to my understanding, the show was a big hit. It showed that you could make people care. I was also a judge on another, you know, game show called the 3-Day Novel Contest. And the first iteration of that contest was fascinating because instead of these contestants fighting each other and trying to destroy each other to win, the show, and the producers didn't even realize this would happen. These contestants actually ended up trying to help each other craft the best manuscripts they could. You know, I mean, that's a magnificent statement, and it made for, it was an eight-part series. It was some of the most compelling TV I'd ever watched, and I'm not saying that because I was in it, because I was only in parts of it. Seeing these people care about each other, that was amazing. So, you know, that's almost like, you know, the people who crash on an island, and instead of trying to eat each other, they try to survive by helping each other. And so, you know, so when we talk about the ratings, there's other ways to get ratings. And it turns out that the paradigm of make people fight each other and screw each other, it's not the only way to win. In fact, it can't win in the end.
Shifting gears again. What is next for you in terms of writing?
Yeah, well, right now I'm working on a variety of projects. I can't give away too many details, but I am working with somebody on making a Coyote Kings movie. We've got a script. He's a Hollywood director who's worked extensively in film and television, and so that's exciting. We've been kind of working on that for a while, so. Right now it's, you know, shopping around for financing, and I'm working on, I wrote a couple of pilot scripts last summer, and I'm now working with a producer on producing a show for actually like young people's television. And you know, I've always got several book concepts on the go, and right now I'm doing some research for a book that deals with the lives of, in Edmonton, a number of African Canadian youth, but particularly the growing Somali Canadian community that is quite poor, but is also you know, quite a flexible, dynamic, and highly entrepreneurial community, and so. Digging into that's sort of my main projects, and I suppose one reason why I'm writing a non-genre book is because Robert J. Sawyer, who's, you know, a mentor to many of us in Canada who are science fiction writers, gave me the advice that he said, you know, I'm sort of depress you with this, John, but he said that science fiction publishing as we know it will be dead in our lifetime. He said that, you know, the writers who have the best shot of any kind of longevity are the ones who are the crossover science fiction writers, people like the late Kurt Vonnegut, Michael Crichton, Margaret Atwood, people whose works are, you know, I mean, even if you think of something like Daniel Keyes's The Flowers for Algernon, brilliant book, brilliant science fiction, Hugo Award winner, and I think The Nebula too, the average person who reads it doesn't even think of it as science fiction. So, meanwhile, the rest of the science fiction industry is in rapid contraction, and some of these publishers are in big trouble, unfortunately. So, I still want to write science fiction, but it's quite clear, and I hate to use corporate speak, but it's clear I'm going to have to rebrand myself as a mainstream writer if I'm going to want to have a future in this.
Does that mean another nom de plume?
Well. Maybe. I mean, I have actually toyed with that idea, and certainly I know a writer who is quite, you know, successful. I mean, she had a number of books out, and, you know, they were award-winning books, but it was a series in science fiction, and the series meant declining sales, and, you know, she realized, consulting with a few other people, her only shot, you know, because bookstores are going to order more books on the basis of how your last book did. So she was looking at, I think the mathematical term is an asymptote. She was seeing her prospects diminishing ever towards zero if this kept up. So she decided, okay, pen name, new type of book, and she's met huge success. I don't know how she does the con circuit then, because people say, hey, wait a second, aren't you so-and-so? I guess at that point she says, well, technically, yes.
That was Malcolm Azania, or Minister Faust. His novel, From the Notebooks of Dr. Brain, won the Philip K. Dick Special Citation this year. Earlier in the podcast, he mentioned The Coyote Kings. The book is The Coyote Kings of the Space Age Bachelor Pad. So at the end of our interview, like the beginning, we ended on some technical difficulties. Malcolm, thank you very much for being on, if you're just joining us.
I just lost you there. Are you still there?
Oh, yeah, you did? Okay. Yeah, I thanked you for being on the show, and then I heard nothing.
Sorry, I thought when you said, I wasn't sure if that was the end, or then you said, if you're just joining us, so I thought that was a...
well, that's the name of my show, which, yeah, confuses everyone.
Oh, okay. All right. So, because usually that's like a segue to, if you're just joining us, then
right.
I'm speaking with author so-and-so, and now to my next question. So, that's the end.
Yes, thank you very much for being on today.
Well, very nice talking with you, John.
That does it for today's show. If you enjoyed it, please feel free to tell friends, family, and enemies. Music in today's show featured The Lounge Bots and Goodbye Cruel World EP by Lucas Nystrand. Well, my name is John Armstrong. I'll see you next time.